A famous story about a young South Sea Islander named Johnny Lingo was made into a movie by the same name. The movie was produced by students of Brigham Young University and is often shown at marriage enrichment seminars. The time has come for Johnny Lingo to marry. For some reason, he has his eye on the one girl who seems to be the butt of village ridicule. She's not fat enough to be a strong worker, and she hides her face all the time because she is so ugly. The village elders presume that Johnny is simply being shrewd. He should be able to get her for one cow, because you can't use half a cow as a marriage dowry. Speculation is high concerning Johnny's business acumen. The father of the bride scorns his daughter because not only will he get only one cow, but also he is sure it will be a scrawny bag of bones in exchange for his scrawny daughter. The cow may be old or swaybacked. The more the father thinks about this pending business of negotiation, the worse he feels. The only redeeming feature is the fact that soon his daughter will be off his hands, and Johnny will have to take the responsibility of caring for her and feeding for such a miserable excuse of a woman. The girl hides in the jungle. She further disgraces her father by being unwilling to be paraded in front of the prospective groom for inspection. It's not that the prospect of public scrutiny and the ignominy of such flagrant male chauvinism necessarily offended her, but she's been made to feel that if she shows her face, somebody would get ill. Finally, the marriage bargaining day arrives. All the men of the village assemble. The women keep their discreet distance, or within hearing, of course. It's definitely a culture where cows have more value than women. Nobody anticipates any surprises. Things would seem cut and dried. Until the moment Johnny Lingo stuns the gathering villagers by praising her whom they have scorned. His offer of 5 cows exceeds the number of cows ever offered in the history of the village. The apoplectic father just sits there with his mouth hanging ajar. Johnny apparently perceives this as a bargaining ploy and quickly ups his offer to 7 cows. Johnny then takes his dramatic exit. Some are sure that Johnny has spent a little too much time in his canoe. Or maybe he's been out in the sun. Or maybe the mystery will be solved when the cows turn up. Oh, that's if the cows turn up. I mean, there are cows and there are cows. The father's sure he's about to be punished for all the bad things he has ever done in his life. Now, he must either wait for bad cows to arrive or cows that may never show up. The next morning, bright and early, 7 of the best cows anybody in the village has ever seen are driven down the path ahead of Johnny Lingo. Johnny and his bride depart. Some months later, the island grapevine reports that Johnny Lingo has the most beautiful wife in Polynesia. It isn't hard to believe, is it? After all, Johnny Lingo's wife is a 7-cow wife. Johnny's wife came to the marriage from a life of depreciation. No wonder she hid in the jungle. Then in one magnificent fell swoop, Johnny changed the ugly duckling into a beautiful swan. The swan he'd always seen when he looked her way. He wasn't playing games. He didn't marry her as some kind of self-punishment. He really perceived her beauty. All the others had been blinded by their prejudice. In that culture, you just didn't marry a skinny woman. Fat was in. It wasn't for Johnny a matter of some fancy bookkeeping. For Johnny, it wasn't jostling and joggling those mental books. It wasn't a matter of psychologically convincing himself that she was beautiful. She actually became beautiful. Perhaps in a way she was already beautiful, but she didn't believe it. Johnny Lingo was simply wise enough to put his cows and his wife into perspective. I mean, you can always get more cows, but such a wife is once in a lifetime. Till death do you part. Doesn't it make sense to take very good care of a 7-cow wife? All Johnny did was to give Sleeping Beauty the kiss of life. He awakened the loveliness that he always knew was there. Actually, that word loveliness comes from the word love, the root word love. You can become lovely in direct proportion to how much you realize that you're loved. If you want a lovely or a more lovely spouse, then be more loving. And these rules also apply in our relationships to our children and our friends. Today we're going to look at some rules to help us to learn to listen. As you've already realized, to get the most out of life, you'll need to be able to get along with people. That means others will like you and want to do things for you. Your personal attitude and action. And when you get along with people, it's because they find your personality positive and pleasing. How can we create a positive personality? I have discovered people are more warmed by how you listen than by what you say. So today we're going to learn to listen. Before you say anything to anyone, ask yourself these three things. Number one, is it true? Number two, is it kind? And number three, is it necessary? Secondly, we need to be aware of the differences that divide. There are differences between all of us: gender, age, interests, differences in our body clocks. For example, you never know what makes some people tick until they begin to unwind. Thirdly, give a smile. Here's the rule. If you're happy, notify your face. A smile is the shortest distance between two crease lines. It's a curve that can set things straight. Herman Melville in Pierre calls it the chosen vehicle for all ambiguities. And ambiguous it is. Argyle and Cook in their book Gaze and Mutual Gaze said, a number of experiments have shown that if an unfriendly message is delivered in a friendly tone of voice and a smiling face, the contents of the message are largely discounted by adults and the message is thought to be friendly. Californian professor Paul Elkman has identified 17 different types of smiles. All smiles are not the same, he says. He identifies firstly the sickly smile that he realized when he was taking a seminar on this topic that his fly was undone. He had a grim smile of a condemned criminal. He describes the say cheese smile of the professional model. Other smiles he identifies are the bitter, the sweet, the scornful, the indolent, the tight-lipped, the cynical, the political, and the triumphant. We, however, can choose to smile with our eyes as well as our face, and this way our smile is genuine. When I suggest a smile, let us remember that a smile costs nothing, and yet it pays dividends. It enriches those who receive it without diminishing the wealth of those that give it. It can happen in a flash, and yet the memory of it can last for a lifetime. It cannot be bought, borrowed, begged, or stolen because it's of no value unless it's given away. A smile must be genuine to have a lasting effect. We sometimes think that the man who can smile when things go wrong has probably thought of someone he can blame it on. But this need not be so. Nobody needs a smile as much as the one who has none to give. Number four. We've just had give a smile, and now number four is read a smile. Dingmeyer and Mackay, in their positive parenting course, assert that one cannot catch the meaning of a sullen look, a broad smile, or a tearful face just by listening. One must learn to catch the meaning of a child's behaviour by tuning in to more than just his or her words. Learning what a smile means in a given situation, you will be listening with your eyes as well as your ears. Number five is to keep an open mind. That is to say, discuss but don't argue. It is possible to disagree without being disagreeable. Before you choose to argue, place a value on your friendship. Number six, to make and to keep a friend, be friendly. Someone said you can make more friends in 2 months by becoming interested in people than in 2 years by trying to get people to be interested in you. I remember many years ago, my young son had just moved into a new primary school, and he came home one day and he said, "Dad, how can I make some friends?" And I had such a simple answer for him: be friendly. And so I say to you today, to make and to keep a friend, be friendly. Number seven is to stand by your friends. Benjamin Franklin said, "Be slow in choosing a friend, slower in changing." To have friends, we must stand by them in adversity. During General Grant's presidency, a man by the name of Conkling had become involved in a scandal at the Senate. I guess I'm not surprised with a name like Conkling. The general attempted in every way to befriend and to shield Mr. Conkling. Another man tried to reason with him. "Tell me, General Grant, how is it you're willing to be his friend? Do you believe what he did was right?" "Oh, no, sir," said General Grant. "Then how is it that you're on his side now?" You know, Grant's reply was a classic. He said, "When is the time for a man to show himself friendly, except when his friend has made a mistake?" That's not the time to leave a man, when he's made a blunder or a mistake. Number eight, be the type of friend that you would like. Think of the type of person you would like to have as a friend, how you would like to be treated, and then be that type of person for others. "Don't walk ahead of me, as I may not follow. Don't walk behind me, as I may not lead, but walk along beside me, that I may be a true friend indeed." Number nine is people need to feel wanted, loved, and needed. So help create these feelings in other people. Boost and build them up, affirm them, and it'll bounce back to you. Number 10 is to be kind to others. You mightn't feel you can love them, but you can be kind to them. You mightn't feel you can like them, but you can be kind to them. You mightn't like their smell, but you can be kind to them. So be kind to others. And number 11, let others impress you rather than you trying to impress them. Number 12. Deliberately do and say things that make other people feel important. Praise, encouragement, support, cooperation, courtesy. Words like please and thank you. In 1954, Dorothy Law Nolte wrote something quite profound, and I've seen it repeated in many publications, usually has anonymous tacked on the end of it. And this is what she wrote. Children learn by what they live. If a child lives with criticism, he learns to condemn. If a child lives with hostility, he learns to fight. If a child lives with ridicule, he learns to feel shy. If a child lives with shame, he learns to feel guilty. If a child lives with tolerance, he learns to be patient. If a child lives with encouragement, he learns confidence. If a child lives with praise, he learns to appreciate. If a child lives with fairness, he learns justice. If a child lives with security, he learns to have faith and belief. If a child lives with approval, he learns to like himself. If a child lives with acceptance and friendship, he learns to find love in the world. Number 13. Never miss an opportunity to compliment somebody or to say something affirming or encouraging to them. You know, I've found that it only takes one person, just one person, to say to me, "You've made my day," and that makes my day. If we must use criticism, it's worth choosing our words well. Len McMillan, in his book Parent Teen, he's actually written a couple of books of this nature. One is called Parent Child, but in his book Parent Teen, he gives an illustration of choosing your words well. A biographer was writing the family history, and as all families have at least one black sheep, Uncle George was theirs. It seemed that Uncle George had been executed in the electric chair for murder. The tactful biographer wrote, "Uncle George occupied a chair of applied electronics at an important government institution. He was attached to the position with the strongest of ties, and his death came as a real shock." Number 14. Never miss an opportunity to say something affirming about your relationship. We've talked about affirming another person, and now say something affirming and confirming about your relationship. Say things like, "I care," or "I value our relationship," or "I like you," or if it's true, "I love you." And say these things often. Phrases such as, "I'm glad I married you," or "I sure enjoy your company," or "I like being with you. It's fun sharing with you. You're important to me." These things value and affirm our relationships. An anonymous writer contributing in the Women's Weekly in July the 6th, 1977, wrote the following verse. "I know our love is deeper now than ever in our courtship days. Without your telling me, somehow I feel it in 100 ways. And it's all very well, I guess, but I remember wistfully how nice it was when you loved me less but told me so more frequently." Number 15. Refuse to talk negatively about others. Don't gossip or listen to gossip. You see, often what we think we hear is not really what we hear. David Siemens, in his book A Healing of Memories, tells of a youngster who overheard his dad telling somebody that the mother had colitis. And the young boy asked, "Who's she been colliding with now?" Billy Graham shares that Augustine had a motto in his dining room on the wall, and this is what it said: "He that speaks an evil word of an absent man or woman is not welcome at this table." What an appropriate motto for every home. Number 16. If you can't say something good about something, then keep silent. Number 17, be positive. A positive attitude attracts others in the same way that a negative attitude repels. We like to be around positive people. And if we're negative, we repel others. And if we're around negative people, we ourselves feel repelled. Number 18 is a very important one. I think we should spend a little bit of time thinking about this one. Number 18 is, if someone criticizes you, ask yourself, whose problem is it? See if there's any truth in what he or she is saying, and if so, then you can make the necessary changes. But if there's no criticism, then it's their problem. So just ignore it and live your life in such a way that no one's going to believe the negative remark. That's what you call learning to listen. Tied in with that is number 19, and that is to let your virtues speak for themselves. You don't need to brag. You don't need to parade. You don't need to even be puffed up if you let your virtues speak for yourself. Number 20, you know, I was told once that if you come across a situation where you're likely to say something that's going to make matters worse, that you should count to 10. Forget it. Forget it. Number 20 is, count to 1,000 before doing or saying anything that could make matters worse. You know, a small town attorney called his first witness to the stand in the trial. And it was an elderly lady. And he approached her and asked, "Mrs. Jones, do you know me?" Oh, she responded, "Why, yes, I know you, Mr. Williams. I've known you since you were a young boy. Frankly, you've been a big disappointment to me. You know, you lie, you cheat on your wife, you manipulate people, you talk about them behind their backs. You think you're a rising big shot, but you haven't got the brains to realize you'll never amount to anything than a two-bit paper pusher. Yes, I know you, Mr. Williams." The lawyer was stunned, not knowing what else to do. He pointed across the room and asked, "Mrs. Jones, do you know the defense attorney?" "Oh, yes. Why, I've known Mr. Bradley since he was a youngster too. I used to babysit him for his parents. And he too's been a real disappointment to me. He's lazy and bigoted. He's got a drinking problem. That man can't build a normal relationship with anyone. And his law practice is the shoddiest in the state. Yes, I know him." At this point, the judge wrapped the courtroom to silence and called both counsellors to the bench. In a very quiet voice, he said with menace, "If either of you asks her if she knows me, I'll have you for contempt of court." So forget about counting to 10. Count to 1,000 before you say anything that's going to make matters worse. Number 21 is to learn to love others because others will often treat you, learn to love yourself because others will often treat you the way you treat yourself. That's probably one way to learn to love others too, isn't it? Love yourself. Theologian Dick Jewett shared with me a rather curious little story that took place many years ago when he was trying to tell his little son about the birds and the bees. You know what I mean, don't you? And this is how he tried to explain it. He said, first of all, there are boy bees and there are girl bees. I really don't know how to tell the difference, but it doesn't matter anyway. Who cares? Leave the things alone, I always say. Now about the birds. Now some birds, you see, go south for the winter and some don't. You can see that Dick was getting a little bit flustered here about what to say and what not to say. But he was brave and he kept going. He said, take for example the one that doesn't fly south, and that's the one that's already south, that's the penguin. Yes, the penguin. If you think it's hard to tell bees apart, you should try penguins, because not even penguins know whether they're a boy or a girl. They all dress the same, the boy penguins walk as funny as the girl penguins. And in addition to that, a penguin without glasses is a very nearsighted person. Now, you might think that all these problems would be an impediment to the courtship of the penguin. Not so. Mother Nature has imbued a special courting custom that either instinctively or passed on from generation to generation by word of beak. It's like this, you see. Once a boy figures out which sex he is, he's to search for a small pebble that adequately expresses his own unique personality. The pebble is to be ceremoniously deposited at the feet of someone whom he hopes is the opposite sex. If the recipient of such high honour just waddles indignantly off looking offended, you must have to pick up your pebble and just go. I mean, anyone can make an honest mistake, even a penguin. The way this curious custom came to light is a more interesting story than the story of the birds and the bees. Now, this is where Dick Jewett gets wise, because he's able to get off the subject quite easily. And he tells the story, and it goes like this. It seems an explorer was standing round one day, minding his own business, when an enormous penguin came up to menace him. At first, his instinct was to flee. But he just stood there and watched this big penguin drop a small pebble at his feet with a dramatic flourish. Well, the explorer didn't know what to do. What do you do? Shake hands? Or what do you do? But just by standing there, he created a grave social blunder. And the penguin followed him around for days. I guess what I'm trying to say, son, says Dick Jewett, is that one of these days you're going to be old enough to start thinking about what kind of pebble best expresses your own true personality. So examine in yourself and see what there is in you that people like about you. And then you can like yourself, and others will like you too. Number 22 is to be enthusiastic. Enthusiasm is contagious. Is yours worth catching? Enthusiasm motivates other people as well as yourself. It builds bonds within relationships. Charles Kingsley said, "We act as though luxury and comfort were the chief requirements in life, when all we need to make us really happy is to have someone to be enthusiastic about, or something to be enthusiastic about." Enthusiasm is contagious, but so is the lack of enthusiasm. We talked about liking ourselves. We talked about being enthusiastic. We're going to put those two together and talk about liking other people. And one way to do that is to help them to like themselves. Remind them that you like yourself better when you are with them. And I draw your attention to our self-esteem seminar that's coming up in a few weeks' time. And there'll be a copy of that on video available too, for those that want it. Number 24 is to call other people by name. Repeat it often in the conversation. In fact, if someone says what their name is and you repeat it back several times in the next few moments, you'll find that it'll stick in your memory and you'll remember it when you meet them again another time. Call them by name and repeat it often. Pastor Matthews tells the following story. We were travelling one day in the Pontico Mountains, and like a good Presbyterian family, we attended church while we were on vacation. One lazy summer we found our way into a little Methodist church. It was a hot day and the folks were nearly out of the pews. The preacher was preaching on and on and on, until all of a sudden he said, "The best years of my life were spent in the arms of another man's wife." The congregation let out a gasp, came to immediate attention. The dozing deacon in the back row dropped his hymn book, and then the preacher said, "It was my mother." The congregation tittered a little and managed to follow along as the sermon concluded. The pastor says, "I filed this little trick away in my memory." It's a great way to get the congregation's attention back when things were dozing off and things getting a bit hazy. Sure enough, next summer, on a lazy Sunday afternoon, I was preaching and the flies were buzzing around and the ushers were sinking deeper into their seats. In fact, they were so low in the back row I could hardly see them. One of the ushers was starting to nod off to sleep, and I let out in a booming voice those words I had heard before. "I spent the best years of my life in the arms of another man's wife." Well, the usher in the back row sat up so quickly he banged his head on the seat in front of him. Another man fell off the chair and onto the floor in the middle of the aisle. I had them. But then you know something? He says, "I forgot what came next, and all I could think of was, and for the life of me, I can't remember her name." To call people by their name shows that you're interested in them as a person, not just as a neighbour, not just as a body to look at, not just someone to say g'day to, but you're interested in them as a person. In the Guinness Book of Names, some people's names are suggested to be ones that maybe oughtn't to be mentioned. In the Bible, we have the story of Joseph. Joseph was taken into slavery in Egypt, and his master was a man by the name of Potiphar. Potiphar is an Egyptian name, and it means fat bull. You know, the name Gulliver, as in Gulliver's Travels, means a glutton. The name MacLeod comes from the Gaelic son of Lochur, which translated means son of the ugly one. Oh, I hope we haven't got any MacLeods here with us today to be embarrassed by that. The name Giddy means the madman. The name Curtis, you've heard the name Curtis, it means, well, it came from the word shorthouse. It actually means the person who wears short socks. The name that was given to Leo Tolstoy. Leo Tolstoy, of course, wrote that great tome, War and Peace. Woody Allen said of that book, "I've read War and Peace, took me about 10 minutes, about the Russian Revolution." Well, Leo Tolstoy had a Russian name. And Leo's Russian name was Lyova Ryova. And I don't speak Russian, but I'm told that means Leo Crybaby, or Little Crybaby. You know, both the importance and the difficulty in remembering names was brought home to me when I was at university. It was a long day, first day of classes, and my last lecture of the day was English. And the new professor came in, elderly gentleman, bespectacled, down. And he leaned on his podium and looked across at the sea of new faces in front of him. And he said, after he'd introduced himself by name, "If you want me to remember your names, please sit in the same seats every day." And then he concluded, "And don't ever change your clothes." There is an importance in remembering people's names. Number 25. Show a genuine interest in people. Listen as you invite them to talk about themselves. Seek their opinions, their viewpoints, their ideas. And number 26 ties in a little bit with that. Number 26 is allow the other person to be right sometimes. I read a very interesting book recently on disciplining children, and it's called What Would Happen If I Said Yes? Number 27 is to have a forgiving view of people. That is to assume the best. Believe that most people are doing the best they can. Pollyanna attitude. Look for the best in people and you will surely find it. Number 28 is to move beyond small talk. Chitter chatter. Argyle and Trower, in their book Person to Person, suggest that small talk is like a Sunday scenic ride, goalless and undertaken for its own sake. Like the unplanned car trip, it can provide great moments of surprise and pleasure, but it often ends up fruitless and boring. I want you to have a look at this overhead I've got here now. This is an iceberg, and right at the top of the iceberg we have the most common form of communication, cliches. This is the g'day, how are you? This is the sort of thing we say to people in the street. Communication moves a little bit beyond that, becomes a little more intimate perhaps when we listen to the news on the television, because that's not cliches, that's reporting facts, reporting information. So that's the second level. A third level is when we start getting ideas and value judgments and these sorts of things come. And I guess you could compare this in one way with the editorial in the newspaper. It combines a number of those earlier ones, but it's moving down to a slightly deeper level. Opinions are coming into fear. And then we have a deeper level of communication still, something we men have a big problem with. And that is expressing our feelings. It's a much more intimate level of communication, and maybe we ought to make it a goal to try and reach down into the depths of the ice to get to that level of communication. And finally, right down the bottom is the intimacy level, that interpersonal communication level that involves the total union of two people as they communicate together. Now, this is all very important, but I would suggest that we avoid communication games. Games imply a win-lose situation. In our families, listening should be win-win. Virginia Satir in People Making lists four common communication games. They are placating, blaming, computing, and distracting. It's important that we realize the power of these responses and the effect that they have on people. The placating response can evoke guilt. The blaming response can evoke fear. The computing response can evoke envy, and the distracting response can evoke a longing for fun. Now, what does this mean? It means that if I evoke your guilt, you might spare me. If I evoke your fear, you might obey me. If I evoke your envy, you might ally with me. And if I evoke your longing for fun, you might tolerate me. But in no case can you love me or trust me, which is, in the final analysis, what makes growth productive in a relationship. Otherwise, all we can do is survive. What does a person bring to this communication process? He brings his body, which moves and has form and shape, body language. He brings his values, those concepts that represent his way of trying to survive and to live the good life, his oughts and his shoulds for himself and others. He brings his expectations of the moment, gleaned from his past experience, also brings in preconceptions, prejudgments. He brings his sense organs, eyes, ears, nose, mouth, skin, which enable him to hear, to see, to touch, to taste, and to be touched. He brings his abilities, his ability to talk, his words, his voice, his ability to hear. He brings his brain, which is his storehouse of knowledge, including that which he's learnt from past experience, what he has read, what he's been taught, his ability to learn, to comprehend, to reason. Now, because of this, number 30, speak directly. We all speak indirectly at times, whether fear of hurting someone's feelings or simply to avoid confrontation. Listening to the way others speak indirectly may help us not to fall into the same trap. Listen to these phrases, spoken by an unnamed boss to his frazzled and frustrated secretary. And read these underlying messages, the indirect messages. When he says, "Don't worry about it," he really means try harder next time. When he says, "Do this when you have a minute," he really means, do this as soon as you can. When he says, "Oh, I don't really have time to explain this," he really means, it's your job to find out. Or more likely, "I don't know, but I'm not going to admit it." When he says, "I think this is a great idea, what do you think about it?" he really means, "I'm not looking for support. I'm not looking for criticism or analysis. I'm looking for agreement." When he says, "Oh, by the way," he really means, "Take note, this is important." And when he says, "Oh, I think we all agree that," he really means, "If you don't agree with me, you'll be conspicuous and out on your own." Number 31 is to cultivate your sense of humour. Laughter is the shortest distance between two people. John Cleese said, "If I can get you to laugh with me, I like me the better, which makes you more open to my ideas. And if I can persuade you to laugh at a particular point I make, by laughing at it, you acknowledge its truth." I read the following example in Kitty's Daily News. Sunday dinner was with my mother, Ada, and my father, Fred, and my three siblings, always a very lively time. On one occasion, all of us, that is, except mother, were in a silly mood, and we began requesting things in verse. "Pass the potato, Ada," or "Pass the meat, Pete," or "I'd give the moon for a spoon." Well, mother got sick of this. She'd heard enough. "Stop this nonsense now," she shouted. "I would like to enjoy my dinner with some good conversation and not all this chatter." And then she sat down in a huff and after a moment said, "Pass the bread, Fred." Number 32 is to cultivate rituals. Rituals are standardized patterns of behavior, which are symbolic rather than instrumental. For example, a handshake doesn't do anything to the other person's hand, but it stands for a change in relationship or accessibility. Rituals can become very formalized, as attested by the French anthropologist Van Gennep, who divided rituals like weddings into three phases: the separation phase, that is the bride from her family, the transition stage, which was the actual wedding itself, and then the incorporation stage, which was the new home with the new family. And rituals don't have to be quite that formalized. We can have rituals on a daily basis, such as family worship. We can have rituals on a weekly basis, such as a special evening meal together or lunch together on the Lord's Day. We can have rituals on a monthly basis, maybe on the first day of the month, telephoning that special friend. We can have anniversaries on an annual basis, remembering something other than our anniversary. The anniversary of our engagement, for example. Anniversary of our first date. I remember sharing this at one seminar I was at, and someone ventured to say, "What about your first kiss?" Well, my wife and I do that anyway when we celebrate our wedding anniversary, because I had to confess to my wife on our wedding day that the only female I had ever kissed up until then was either a blood relative or on four legs. Number 33 is to value appropriate touching. One scientist carried out the survey at the rate that people touch each other in public, and he videoed people that were sitting in outdoor restaurants, these al fresco dining areas. And for each video segment, the duration was 1 hour, and he counted the number of times that people actually touched during that 1 hour. And it was rather interesting. In San Juan, in Puerto Rico, he found that the touching was 180 times in an hour. In Paris, it was 110 times. In Gainesville, which is in Florida, it was only 2 times. And an hour of filming in London, 0. Not 1. Spencer Michael Free wrote this. He said, "'Tis the touch, the human touch, in this world that counts, the touch of your hand and mine, which means far more to me than the fainting heart, more than shelter and bread and wine, for shelter is gone when the night is o'er, and bread lasts only a day. But the touch of the hand and the sound of the voice sing on the soul away." Spencer mentions another factor in his poem, and that is the sound of the voice. "I love to hear my wife's voice. When she talks to me, it has a musical lilt that remains long after I've forgotten what she said." If I keep that up, that lovely lilt might become a memory too. So value appropriate touching, but we need also to be considerate of other people's personal space. We've all got about 0.9 of a square meter of personal space, and we prefer others, especially strangers, to stay out of it. Being aware of that can help us to value and respect other people's personal space. If I come right up to you and it got right up close to your face, you wouldn't like it, would you? That's personal space. Number 35 is to learn to make love to your partner. We have got a special little sealed handout. And for those squeamish ones, I'm going to read to you what it says. It's an amazing 3-step process to make love to a woman. And I might add that men can use this to make love to a woman, but the women can also use the same 3 steps to learn to make love to a man. And we're getting pretty intimate here, aren't we? Okay, here are the amazing 3 steps. Number 1, is to lovingly ask her what she wants. Number two is to lovingly listen while she answers. And number three is to lovingly do what she asks. Now, if you have respect for the other person and for their needs and wants and desires, then you will make love and you will learn to listen. Now, here's a short course in communication. The most important six words are, I admit I made a mistake. The most important five words are, I'm proud of you. The most important four words are, what is your opinion? The most important three words are, I love you. The most important two words are, thank you and please. The most important three-letter word is you. The most important two-letter word is us. And the least important one-letter word is I. Number 12, be honest. Honesty often hurts. It makes us vulnerable. But honesty always wins in the end. The key to a successful marriage is honest, open communication about functions, fellowship, family, friends, finance, friction, faith, and the future. You know, when I used to counsel couples prior to marriage, I would emphasize the necessity of honesty in those eight areas. The basic functions of marriage, they are fellowship, friends, family, finance, friction, faith, and the future. The danger of little lies is highlighted by a story that I read many years ago by Sylvia Garfield. This is what she said. Having booked a taxi to take my husband and me to the theatre, I put the cat out and waited. The taxi arrived, and just as I opened the front door for the taxi driver, the cat dashed inside and ran up the stairs. My husband went in search of the animal, leaving me to go with the driver out to the taxi. I was pretending that there was still somebody in the house, and the house was going to remain occupied, so I lied to the driver. This is what I said. He'll be down in a moment, talking about my husband. He's just saying goodbye to my mother. A few minutes later, my husband rejoined me, and he said, the silly old thing was hiding under the bed. I had to poke her out with a coat hanger. In Catherine Marshall's book, Christie, Miss Alison Henderson, in the film version, it was actress Tyne Daly. She said, if you would conquer a lie, you must tell the truth. And so we can use honesty to counter lies as well as to replace them. It's much easier to tell the truth in the first place. Nobody's going to know you're honest unless you give out samples. And what follows naturally is the caution to make promises sparingly and to keep them faithfully. Number 38 is to give whole attention. A former Prime Minister of Britain said, we must not only govern, we must be seen to be governing. And that's also true of listening. Remember, we're here to learn to listen. A good listener doesn't just sit motionless. taking it all in. But he keeps up a constant flow of, well, mainly non-verbal signals. And if he doesn't, the speaker thinks he's not listening at all, and will probably stop speaking. Attention signals include sitting in an alert posture, looking often at the speaker, intermittently nodding and smiling, even making various noises of acknowledgement. Things like, or really. Or an American might say, "Oh, you don't say," even if you do. Or an Italian might say, "Si, si, si." A good listener lets the speaker know what he thinks of his statement. So intermittently, and particularly at the end of a speaker's sentence, he'll smile or frown to show whether he likes or dislikes what has been said. He raises his eyebrows to show surprise, or he lowers them to show puzzlement. He nods and shakes his head to show agreement or disagreement. One of the most important signals is to, number 39, create and maintain eye contact. We all speak with our eyes, the windows to our soul. Our eyes can laugh or cry, they can twinkle or wrinkle, glance or dance. And they can show whether we're really listening. Deborah McKinley, in her book Secrets, says men find it easier to talk when they're travelling in a car because they don't have to look at each other. If I want to tell you I really care, I look into your eyes. Just observe new lovers. They don't gaze into each other's eyes. They gaze into each other's souls. Through their eyes. They look into each other's eyes as though they're looking into the very depths of the being of that other person. So learn to look while you listen. Show by your eyes that you are giving focused attention. And finally, number 40, do not seek so much as to be consoled, but to console. Do not seek so much to be understood as to understand. Do not seek so much to be loved as to love. These are your tools to listen.